Baseball Tonight, the podcast.
This is the Baseball Tonight podcast for Thursday, June 4th, 2020, producing from his home in Connecticut, his home studio, Taylor Schwenk. I'm Buster Olney, working from my home studio in New York. News and notes today as we get going. The Pirates' Chris Archer is going to miss this season, whatever season that is, however it's defined. He's going to be out at least until 2021 after having surgery yesterday. Dr. Robert Thompson performed surgery on the 31-year-old right-hander Tuesday in St. Louis to relieve symptoms of thoracic outlet syndrome. The Pirates hold an $11 million option on Archer for 2021, but let's face it, given the medical concerns, given the salary, the shifting landscape in baseball for finances with the money being lost, I'd be shocked if they actually picked up that option. Major League Baseball finally released a statement about racism entitled "Our Game Has Zero Tolerance for Racism." This was 9 days after George Floyd died while in police custody in Minneapolis. Major League Baseball said as part of a statement that "our game has zero tolerance for racism and racial injustice. MLB is committed to engaging our communities to invoke change," among other words. They're getting a lot of criticism because they were just too slow to react to events. ESPN and The Athletic are reporting that Major League Baseball told the union it does not plan to make a counterproposal to the proposal that the players made on Sunday, which was for 114 games. Major League Baseball told the union has no interest in extending the season into November when it fears a second wave of the coronavirus could disrupt the season. Taylor, that all said, I will tell you, I got a little flicker of hope overnight that there might be a sincere effort for these two sides to actually go into the middle ground. You know, I've been like Dr. Doom during this thing. I'm just going to tell you, I got a little flicker of hope, and maybe it gets extinguished like everything else in these conversations, but it was one of the first real flickers of hope that I heard.
Can you elaborate on that at all? Because I feel like I read that report that they're not going to counter, and I felt lower than ever, so I need it. Bring it on.
I'm just telling you, I'm not going to overstate it. Just going to tell you, I got a little flicker of hope. I will talk with Clint Yates coming up about where the players and the owners stand and what might happen if there were like a 50-game season. We're also going to be talking with Paul Mbakides about which players might be better off skipping a short season in 2020. Before we get to that, on ESPN Daily, Major League Baseball Hall of Famer Andre Dawson played a stellar 21 seasons. His second career is totally unrelated. He owns and operates a funeral home where he's seeing families through their grief. That's ESPN Daily. Listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Clint Yates is the columnist for The Undefeated. You see him on Around the Horn. You hear him on ESPN Radio. And Clinton, I got to say, when we put in the request to have you on this week, and we always tape our show usually in the 9 to 10 hour, I didn't realize till afterward, oh my God, you're in LA. And I was like, you're getting up early joining us. I appreciate it.
No problem, man. I mean, you know, as somebody who moved out here just a couple months ago, that's part of the routine. But sometimes you don't always get up and talk first thing in the morning. You get up and send emails and so forth. But no, I'm glad to be here. And yeah, Los Angeles has been lovely. So the weather is keeping me sane in an otherwise trying time in the world and in America.
All right. The biggest tension in my marriage is that when I wake up, I am 0 to 60 in 0.2 seconds. Are you not that way in the morning?
I'm absolutely that way in the morning. I'm definitely a morning person. I just have to be awake. That's the only difference. So, you know, that's all there is to that.
All right. I was following your Twitter feed yesterday, and you were doing a cool thing. You wrote, "Look, for all those who've asked, I've gone primarily the self-care route, which is to say, talking about things that make me happy is simply what I'm going to do whenever I get the chance, no matter the topic." So going to do that now. And then you started to post baseball cards and pictures. And I absolutely love that. You know, one of them was one of the best people I've met in the game, Charles Johnson. So sort of take me through that yesterday.
So here's the deal. I, as a baseball fan, one of the things that I love about the game is not just the major league level, Buster. This is something I've talked about a lot. I like the game for what it's worth at all forms, from little league all the way up to the top flight. Now, as a result, one of the things that interests me a lot is certain guys who got to the game in certain ways, or they started playing Major League Baseball and they weren't stars. They might have been big time at other levels, at the amateur level or what have you. And a lot of those players from the 80s and 90s happen to be brothers. So what I have, if you've ever seen me on Around the Horn or on any other programs across our fine quality network, you've seen my background. And my background is a wall in my kitchen where I put up basically a shrine to the average black player. That's basically just what I do. And my buddy, who recently had a death in his family, he inherited a bunch of cards from his uncle, whom he had a relationship with that was very much built on the memorabilia side. Personally, as a kid growing up as a baseball fan who collected baseball cards, who ended up getting into newspaper design, editor roles, and writing about the game, I realized not just in terms of what they represent, baseball cards from a collection standpoint, but like you break down the design and the photojournalism on some of these things and just the writing, baseball cards to me are such a fascinating news peg into so much of the game. And that's why I posted them the way that I did, Buster. You post the front and the back, you know, and you make a notation about something you saw because somebody put that together. It's more than just the memory of the player. It's about what the actual card looks like visually, which is why I have them up on my home set for television. It's all wrapped together and I love it.
Yeah, one of them, for example, I loved the one you had of Joe Carter. And you're noting that the best one doesn't, you don't even see his face, if you can explain that.
Basically, on the front of that Beckett issue, now for those who don't know what Beckett is, Beckett was the magazine that listed all the prices for the cards back in the 80s and 90s. Beckett became an extremely influential publication in the world of baseball overall because of how high quality the memorabilia industry was at that point from an influence standpoint. So the Beckett covers and the Beckett magazines were huge. That particular cover had Michael Jordan on the front. Back when he was playing for the White Sox, we all saw that in the 30 for 30 episode in which they chronicled that tale. Now, on the back of that episode is, of course, a picture of Joe Carter taking Mitch Williams out to win the World Series for the Blue Jays. Now, the big picture is a photo of Mitch Williams walking away. Excuse me. The big picture is a photo of Joe Carter, you know, and the look on his face after he hit that homer. The small inset picture is Mitch Williams walking away and Joe Carter with that memorable jumping around the bags. You can only see the number 29 from the back, and it's the coolest photo, as well as it being right next to a shot of his awesome high-top Nikes the guys wore back in the day. Everything about that magazine is just such a great time capsule of not just what the game was, but how we presented the game to fans who were of a young age like I was at the time.
Tell me about one or two favorite baseball cards that you had growing up as a kid. I've told the story in the podcast before how my mom in 1973 got me two packs of baseball cards. I was 9 years old. And the first two players I ever looked at, one was an infielder named Gary Sutherland, and the other was Lee May, who, of course, played years and years in the big leagues.
Right.
And what I didn't realize, and this was, you know, me being a nine-year-old and not really knowing about statistics, but that card had a weird error on it, and it was Lee May with his bat extended, and I think it was Lee May hit well in the 1970 World Series, and at the end of his bat, Clinton, the batting average that was written into his bat was .000. So I was trying to make sense of that as a nine-year-old. Why are they celebrating the fact that Lee May batted zero? He didn't actually, but right. Why are they celebrating that fact? But that was like emblazoned in my head. And so years later, when I was covering the Orioles and I got to meet Lee May, that was always in the back of my mind. For you, what were some baseball cards that you really liked?
The cards I love best, Buster, are the sets I can think of that had the best designs. I get back to that from, you know, actually a legitimate journalism standpoint. I remember the Score 1990 box. It had like five different base colors that all rotated through different guys. I remember the Leaf 1991, I believe, that had the silver border. So for me, it was legit. It was just as much about what the cards looked like as it was the players. Now, one of the ones that I've been highlighting and some of the ones that I've been highlighting are guys from a certain era that back when they took pictures in spring training and stuff, and guys would be styling. I mean, for me, what they show about what the game looked like in terms of uniforms, in terms of hairstyles, in terms of, you know, catching stances and things that people don't even do, those are the best. And the guy I think about all the time when I think about the era of player coming together with everything I just talked about, Delino DeShields. He was a dude who was a style icon from the Eastern Shore of Maryland, sort of around, you know, the DC area, like we've talked about before in terms of big time baseball talents. And every time you saw him on a card, he was swagging out. So I loved Leonard DeShields cards for everything it represents beyond just a player and who he was as an infielder with the Spos.
All right. You've heard of the book Cardboard Gods.
Yes.
Okay. This is one of the, I don't think I've ever talked about this in the podcast. It was written by a man named Josh Wilker. Josh and I played Little League together in Randolph Center, Vermont.
Wow.
We played, his older brother Ian and I were very close friends. Josh and I, you know, got to be good friends. He was the younger brother, and they actually worked on our farm stacking hay with me when we were all kids, 9, 10, 11, 12 years old. We played on the Mets together. And Josh in the book, he makes references because this came out like in, you know, like 15 years ago or 10 years ago, his book did. He makes references to me as someone who would go on to write about baseball. But yeah, we all grew up playing Little League together.
And someone who would go on to write about baseball. I love that.
Yeah. And so anyway, and Josh, you know, he tells stories through those baseball cards. And if you haven't gotten a chance to read that book, it's fantastic. But I could talk about baseball cards all day because I got about, when I was a kid, about 30,000 of them. You know, for me, as someone who didn't have a television, only listen to games on radio, it was like my way to connect.
I totally hear you. And now, one of the things, and just quickly to wrap this up, one of the reasons why I display them so much is because, again, their physical existence is part of the reason why I like the game. And don't get me wrong, Buster, I love picking up grounders, running bags, and taking signs as much as the next guy as a player and somebody who watches and covers the game now. But those were the fun parts, the cards, not just the players, the whole experience of being around everybody, trading things back and forth, and finding out the information that you didn't otherwise know, those little tidbits. I mean, it represents everything. That's why cards are cool to me.
All right. What's your take on the current status of the labor negotiations? I feel like that the worst possible scenario is no baseball. The second worst possible scenario is a situation where one side basically rams a deal down the throats of the others and they don't really collaborate. If they play 50 games, that's what it would be.
I think the worst case scenario is baseball that gets truncated and is not allowed to finish. No baseball, to me, at least indicates we realize we have enough of a problem that we have to take an actual step back and look at this for what's involved in the CBA down the line. 2020, arguably, I think in the minds of reasonable fans, being a wash would not be something that is, you know, irreparable. And I mean that in terms of the relationship of the game with the fans. You know what I'm saying? Like, not just in terms of how the union and owners deal with each other. I think if you look at this and MLB says, yo, we're not playing because we're losing all this money. Well, how much money are you really losing? And then they never really reveal it. And all these players who are putting themselves on the front line, all these players who would be putting their families at risk, I think the players have more leverage in public opinion than people realize. But the fans are the ones that are the most scared. It's so weird, Buster. Like, baseball fans tell me all the time, oh, we're going to lose everybody. I'm like, have you watched a baseball game recently? It's as regional a sport at the major league level as anything else. I don't think they're losing some crap ton of people, you know what I'm saying, just because a season has gone away. I really actually believe that. This is a crazy time in America. To not be able to gather for a baseball game is normal. And I think that if the 2020 season goes away, but the longer term health of the game from a CBA standpoint is what actually ends up being gained, that's okay. Now, the worst case scenario, I think, of course, is if they shove something down their throats, as you said, Buster, they come back. And the next thing you know, we've played 50 odd games and we don't get the playoffs because some other outbreak happened. And that would be worse, in my opinion, than never getting started at all in 2020.
How confident are you that because I agree with you in theory, but I don't have confidence that if they were to defer this season because you get an imperfect product, that they would actually use that time productively. The relationship between the two sides is the worst that it's been in 25 years.
I'm not extremely confident, but I can tell you one thing. I don't think that the MLB owners group leadership realized how much of a vicious blow they dealt to their own case by how they've handled the minor league situation. And if public pressure comes from that side in terms of, hey, look, you guys are going to kill the game just to spite players on principle? Like, are you serious? I think that will force a lot of people who are fans of this game, not just of the league, to reevaluate what they consider the purpose of Major League Baseball to be. If you're going to talk about developmental systems and you're going to talk about trying to bring people into the sport, it's about daggone time anyway that Major League Baseball started accepting their role as a top flight entity and not just as one particular league competing against all other forms of baseball. That's a personal opinion. And I think this might be what gets us there, because people are going to be forced to look at this and say, well, if we don't even have the major leagues, what can we expect of anything else in terms of what players want to do to get motivated? I got minor leaguers, Buster, hitting me up, asking me if I think, as a journalist, their futures are in doubt because they're not communicating with their teams because their teams have nothing to say to them. How crazy is that? I mean, that to me is such a sad state of affairs on a level much larger than just whether or not we can go out to the ballpark and watch a game. It's about the employment. It's about the relationship between labor and ownership and what the actual purpose of what we're doing here is, which is to bring a sport that people love to the masses so that people can be entertained. It does not appear that that is what the goal of ownership is, because they're bogged down in this question of fairness and profits, which is reasonable, but also ineffective at this point towards a larger goal.
What did you think of the way that it played? It's case in point of what you're talking about. Of course, the Washington Nationals, who we heard they were going to reduce the weekly stipend for minor leaguers from $400 to $300. Okay. From $400 a week to $300 a week for the richest owners in baseball, the Lerner family. And then Sean Doolittle tweeted out, what was it, on Sunday, saying that we've been talking among the major leaguers, we're going to give the minor leaguers money. Then suddenly the Nationals, knowing that they were not going to look very good, they reversed course. What did you think of how all that played out?
It was unimpressive, to say the least, and it was also disingenuous, to probably say the worst. I mean, the Lerners being the richest team in all of baseball doesn't even begin to describe how I feel they sort of approach the game. That being the case, they have so much money. For all of you all listening who don't understand what the Lerners operate, you know, as a business like, they own real estate in the District of Columbia and its environs, the capital of the United States of America, one of the most hardcore, high luxury real estate markets on the globe. They are rich. They have plenty of money to go around. And so for them to come out publicly as World Series champions, no less, Buster, and say that they're reducing the stipend was, I can't even think of the word. It was unconscionable on a certain level. Forget about being a fan of the team. Just from looking at that, you thought to yourself, if you can't at this exact moment spoil anybody involved in your franchise coming off of a championship season, well, then what on earth are you doing here? Why can't this be something that you at least extend like other teams have done, to cut back and then have your own players undermine your own effort? To me, it was deeply embarrassing for them. And I'm not saying that in a way that necessarily means that anybody's going to turn their fanhood or all of a sudden start showing up to Nats Park and booing the Lerners. It's not like that. It's just one of those things where you look at it and you say, man, you guys got kind of lucky with this. You ran through a buzzsaw of a playoff performance. This team was wallowing in the mire for many years, and you were trying to build a baseball culture. You got a championship, and this is how you turn around after all this talk of how you have family and all of this community feeling? Bro, off message and just not hitting the mark at all. I think the Nationals have some serious PR rebuilding to do in their community.
Yeah, 100%. There was an example of that in early April when the Pittsburgh Pirates owner Bob Nutting made the decision to stop to suspend the team's contributions to 401k plans. And I turned around and asked about it, and I said, how much money does that really save? And what I got back was tens of thousands of dollars per month. And I get it that the Pirates are not necessarily a really wealthy team, but for a franchise worth $1 billion to $2 billion, saving tens of thousands of dollars? Come on.
Yeah.
The other day, you know, Tom Rick had a conversation with our Jesse Rogers, did a great job getting that interview. We heard from Ken Kendrick, the chairman of the Diamondbacks, him talking about their situation. And Clinton, I, you know, as I listened to those guys or read their quotes, I was thinking to myself, you know what? They're better dressed than Blake Snell was when he was sitting in front of his computer playing video games. You know, they weren't wearing a headphone. But I would give him the same advice that I would give to Blake Snell. Stop talking. No one wants to hear about it.
There's a large part of that. But at the same time, I think the reason why the players are doing this and the reason why it's important for guys like Blake Snell to be out there is because I don't think the average fan is really understanding how deep these cuts are on a basic level. Forget about, I mean, this is going to sound weird, but forget about the big leagues right now. Just think about the pool of players that exist in the country that are capable of playing Major League Baseball. That number is not high. No. If we talk about the competition level that we're used to, half of those guys are in the big leagues and arguably probably aren't playing a Major League Baseball level. And that's a half is a large number. I'm just being flippant for the purposes of this example. If the major leagues and the owners don't understand that investing in that part of the product is what actually helps them, well, then you've completely misunderstood what the purpose of being a part of the sport is. And that's the main thing that bugs me about the minor league factor. Forget about the stipend. Cutting off the games because you claim you're going to lose money, yo, the one thing you have to invest in is the players. You don't have a choice. They're playing the actual game. And so for the strategy to be, well, A, we're not really focused on development from a play standpoint, and B, we're certainly not concerned about their larger life levels in terms of, you know, their ability to be happy and to sustain themselves. That's crazy to me. Like, that is legitimately cutting off your nose to spite your face. And on top of that, trying to diminish your sense of smell on top of killing your nose. You know, like, it's such a bizarre method to me that I think that the players at this point have to say something. They're not playing anyway. This is not a labor agreement that's, you know, trying to be done in the midst of a game. The fact that nobody's playing, I think, allows people to see, yo, dog, yeah, you might want to actually get the players back out onto the field, because otherwise you're not going to play games. I mean, this is the one time that that works, because you can't use a pandemic as leverage. That's slimy.
Clinton, they may reach some sort of an understanding. They might put in a plan to have players come back. I'm not totally sure that all players are going to participate. This is based on my conversations with agents and people on the player side. I'll give you a couple of examples, which, and I think it absolutely, the parallel would be the college football star, the NFL prospect who skips a bowl game,
yep,
or skips the combine. And I'll give you a couple examples. Mookie Betts, okay, he's traded to the Los Angeles Dodgers because of the agreement that they had back in March. He's going to get his service time. He's going to be a free agent in the fall. Another example, George Springer. His career began with service time manipulation. The Astros held him down in the minor leagues. He should have been a free agent last fall, but he wasn't coming up. And last year, it was the best season of his career. Given the timing of everything, he probably could have gotten a deal like $200 million last fall when Anthony Rendon was getting, what, $245 million.
Big money.
And so now we have a situation. You get COVID-19, a short season. If I'm George Springer, if I'm Mookie Betts, and it's 50 games and it's a small sample and you have the risk of injuries, I'm seriously thinking about not participating. And I think there are a lot of potential free agents I would put in that category. And by the way, and look, there definitely would be legitimate health concerns, coronavirus. Folks have family members that are vulnerable and you wouldn't want to expose them. But you do have some cover if your decision is financial as well, where you could say, I'm concerned about the health issues, while in the back of your mind, knowing that, you know what, I'm not going to gamble all that as a free agent in the fall. What do you think?
I'm 100% with you. And I'll add to that list, Chris Archer, who's with the Pirates, who decided to get surgery, even though, yep, he's got a team option coming up. That's a brilliant move to me. You have to do that. That's the way that the players are going to figure out whether or not the owners are really about this action. If guys like a Mike Trout, who literally said, if you think I'm walking from a ballpark to a hotel room and sticking my family in that hotel room for 3 months just so we can have a baseball game and I'm putting myself at risk, you're nuts. You know what I mean? And if that guy, people who didn't even know the sound of his voice, suddenly all of a sudden we're hearing him talk about what he did not want to do and what he did not think was safe, you've got a completely different landscape in terms of what the everyday player is looking at. Because number one, it gives the everyday player perhaps a chance to play, which is an awkward division between guys. But it gives dudes who have any reason at all a legitimate leg to stand on. I think you're exactly right, Buster. Between Blake Snell talking about this, between all of the guys you mentioned, I mean, Springer's interesting too, because the entire concept of service time manipulation, I think, is something that the average baseball fan doesn't understand a lot of. And if you look at it in terms of what the concessions that are going to be made and not made, the fact that they get service time for the season at all is massive. That's like a huge coup, because otherwise this would have been a real robbing of the experience and just everything. And so I am never going to argue with anybody for trying to make sure that their service time is maximized in the bigs, because that is the biggest racket going in the entire labor market of sports in the country, not including NCAA, but that's a whole other story. I'm agreeing with you. I think that there will be a lot of players, and I don't just mean big time guys. I mean dudes who, between the risk, the financial reward, and just frankly, the grind that's going to be setting up if it turns out to only be a 50 game season and you're playing for somebody, for some team that's not going to make the playoffs, that's a weird run. I almost think that if you don't get to go long enough, like to at least 75, you're going to have a completely different setup in terms of how guys prepare physically for such a season. A sprint run is not what baseball is about. And I don't care if you've not been playing ball, you also haven't been conditioning the same way. So it's going to be a little different. This, to me, if you have the option to not play, is the smarter option, in fact, because you're putting yourself at too much risk. You don't know what the product is going to be like that you're going to get. And there's no guarantee that you're going to, you know, there's no guarantee that it's going to work. You might end up having to come back home anyway. So overall, I'm with you 100%, which is why I'm stunned that they are doing so much from the owner standpoint to not make all these things work. If it's only about the money and it's not about the principles of baseball, man, that sucks to think that that's a reason why 2020 might not happen. And down the line, the CBA is going to be a problem.
There's no doubt about that. All right, Clinton, keep posting those pictures.
Buster, I'll be back again today. I have another issue of Beckett in the holster, so I'm very excited about that. Good to talk to you.
Jumping into the numbers.
After evaluating millions of pieces of data in the blink of an eye, the winner is Cincinnati by 200 points. Bye, you worthless hunk of junk.
This is Hembo Knows.
Hembo is Paul Embiakides. We know for sure that he's a researcher for ESPN. He's told us he's the head honcho of the show, Get Up. What we've also heard is that he's a wild partier who through whom Michael Greenberg lives vicariously. I don't know how we're going to define that and break that all down, but that's who you are, Hembo.
That's a very long font for the topic bar. And I have to also have to say that means Greeny's not living so well if he's living vicariously through me, as you boys well know.
Yeah, right. Now, we've heard the stories, you know, out after curfew and all that. I got it. All right.
Okay, fair enough.
So I was just talking to Clinton Yates about George Springer. I made my case to him that, you know, given the way that his service time was manipulated at the start of his career, that cost him tens and tens of millions of dollars, with the way this is all played out, I wouldn't blame someone like George Springer for simply saying, you know what, I'm not going to play 50, 60 games and put myself at risk. I'm just going to sit it out, and I'm just going to wait for free agency. What do you think?
Well, there are a couple of branches to that notion, I think. The first is, I think it would be very difficult for a player to make that decision because he knows the kind of backlash that he would receive publicly, especially as it relates to the fan base. But we have seen this to varying extents for college football players before the end of the NFL draft. We've seen a lot of guys skip out, sit out bowl games. And as we know, not only does that obviously mitigate risk in some sense because of injury, but it also has not hurt their draft stock. Teams don't care if they choose to do that. I can't imagine there's a team out there that would say, oh, George Springer chose not to play 50 games last year. We don't want him on our team. That's not how front offices think. Like you said, they're not emotional now. They're rational. I'm going to give you two more names of some guys who I think could make a similar decision as George Springer for slightly different reasons. Buster, the first is Marcus Semien. He turns 30 in September, and through 2019, Buster has earned only, of course, in air quotes, $11 million. He's coming off a season in which he produced nearly 9 WAR and finished third in the American League MVP vote. Further, his OPS plus of 138 marked the first time in his career that his league-adjusted batting line was above average. If I am Marcus Semien, again, turning 30, that is the last taste I want in the mouth of my next employer. There's also a pitcher who I think could benefit from this notion potentially, and that's Mike Minor. He led all pitchers in wins above replacement last season, who in 2019 as a 31-year-old logged his first 200-inning season since 2013. He has struggled with some injuries. Buster, we talked about this last summer, but he has made huge strides, especially against right-handed hitters, in upping his changeup usage, registering 58 strikeouts with it against just 12 extra base hits last season. Again, like Semien, another player whose 2019 performance, I would want that being the last taste in my next employer's mouth. What I don't know, Buster, is what the market's going to be like for free agents next year. Now, obviously, they're going to hit free agency regardless, but I think there's a real chance that the market is very suppressed considering the fact that Major League Baseball is going to make just a small percentage of the money that it did last year, this year, and that's if we play at all, which, of course, is still to be determined.
Well, and everything you said, I think, is exactly right, and it's at face value. But here's the X factor in this whole thing. You have some cover, Hembo, if you want to sit out the season. You can legitimately say, you know what, I have health concerns. I am worried about the coronavirus. I've seen how it's affected people. And you could just say, I'm not going to participate because of the concerns I have about coronavirus and about player safety.
You can definitely say that in good conscience. I think it would be somewhat suspicious. I guess I would use that word for someone like George Springer to say it, because we know he's entering a contract year. But you can in good conscience tell someone not to show up if they in their right mind don't feel right about doing it and potentially exposing their family or friends to it. Like, there's going to be a real consideration here, you know, with that coming down the pike. And there's going to be more than a handful of players that have to make that tough decision. I bet a few people will err on that side.
Oh, I 100% agree. And as I say, I think for a lot of potential free agents, it's something to think about, because if you looked at it like a poker game and you're playing your odds, you know, playing those 50 games, risk of injury, that sort of thing for a potential free agent, and where you know that you have a lot of money on the line, it just doesn't make a lot of sense. All right. If there is a short season, who's historically a fast starter?
Well, Bryce Harper is a historically fast starter, Buster. He's one of seven players in Major League history with an OPS north of 1,000 in the months of March and April. The other six are Babe Ruth, Ted Williams, Barry Bonds, Jimmy Fox, Mark McGwire, and Rogers Hornsby. And that's the kind of company he's keeping in terms of how he starts a season. And obviously, March and April in a normal season only is, you know, 15-20% of your plate appearances. Over the course of a season like that, we're talking about half of your plate appearances. So sprinters like Bryce Harper, probably more favorable in this kind of setup.
You're right about that. It always seems like we get to mid-May, Bryce Harper's leading the world in every category, and then they start walking him, and then everything just kind of begins to fray a little bit. All right, who's historically a slow starter?
So we'll call this the Martha Shiro rule, but the active player that I would tab as this is Alex Bregman. Buster, over the last three seasons, Bregman owns the fourth best batting line after the month of April, behind only Mike Trout, J.D. Martinez, and Christian Yelich. Once the weather warms, so does his bat. But in the months of March and April, he ranks 84th. He's sandwiched between Asdrubal Cabrera and Marcell Ozuna. Guys like him, guys who are notoriously slow starters, are going to have to make sure they get their timing down in spring training so they don't suffer from that again.
You're exactly right. No doubt about it. It'll be very interesting to see how players handle this and which guys actually do get off to hot starts and which guy, you know, I can't remember who the player was that it was referred to as Operation Shutdown. I think we're going to see some of that among the second division teams.
I'm going to interrupt you real quickly because you spend a lot more time in spring training than I have. But if we can get this thing sorted out and these guys are only given 3 weeks, I think we're going to see teams and players take those reps way more seriously than we do before, sort of using the Mark Teixeira rule as our example. We'll see how it goes. But I think that's going to be a big storyline as we approach a season.
No doubt about it. All right, Hembo, enjoy the parties.
Later, boys.
Bleacher Tweets.
Alrighty, Bleacher Tweets for Thursday. Got some new names here. Excited to see them. We got Kevin Sploit at Global Travel 62. He writes in, I have always thought that great baseball players can rarely make great managers. The skill set is very different. Can you name three? This seems like a challenge from Kevin.
And I got to tell you, I guarantee you that you're going to hear from Kevin for your pronunciation of his last name. Take another look. You said like Sploit, and look at it again.
Sploit.
Kevin, let Taylor know, you know, send him a tweet and let him know how to pronounce your name. But it was a great question. You're right. Great baseball players rarely made great managers. The skill set's very different, for sure. You know, some really good players have been good managers. I was thinking about Dusty Baker, who had almost 2,000 hits in his career, 242 homers, two All-Star appearances. Joe Torre was a great manager, Hall of Fame manager. He was actually the MVP of the National League in 1971. But, you know, he wasn't an elite player. Felipe Alou was a terrific player, but not a superstar. Lou Piniella, Leo DeRocher. Maybe the best great player who became a manager for a long time, Frank Robinson. He managed 16 seasons, but you know what, Kevin? He never reached the postseason as a manager. So generally speaking, I think that's right. I think that a lot of great players have a hard time relating to players on a day-in and day-out basis because the game probably was easier for them.
Thank you for your tweet, Kevin Seipolt.
There you go.
Yes. All right. Next up, Zane at Liberty Zane writes in, watching the replay of the 2008 ALDS, and it struck me how long John Lester has been around. Took a glance at his baseball reference page, and I wonder, how many years do you think he has left, and what would he need to do to build a case as a Hall of Famer?
Yeah, I'd say 2 or 3 years left. I think he's going to get into the Hall of Fame no matter what happens. I don't know if right now he would get in through the writer's vote. I think at the very least he'd be an excellent Veterans Committee selection. Think about his career. 190 wins, 108 losses, 3.56 ERA. That's all excellent. Adjusted ERA plus for his career is 120. That's right in the range of some other Hall of Famers. And he has that tremendous postseason history. 26 games. 2.51 ERA. I think he helps his chances for getting in on the writer's vote once he goes over 200 wins. And I know we don't care about wins as much as we used to as a statistic, but I just think that those benchmarks are important for writers.
Last one for today, Andrew DeSalvo at DeSalvotion. If Major League Baseball does happen with many fewer games, what in-game coaching decisions do you think will be most different than during a 162-game season? More bunting, stealing, pitchers, all going 2-3 innings at most. What do you think?
Andrew, if you don't remember 2020 as baseball's year of COVID-19, I think you can think of it as year of the reliever. I think relief pitchers are going to have a huge impact on what we're going to see because starting pitchers won't be fully ramped up. And then once we get into the postseason, it'll be all about matchups. And keep in mind, I mean, we don't have the exact numbers yet of how big these rosters are going to be, but I think there's going to be a huge table of relief pitchers available to each team.
That's it for Bleacher Tweets. Shout out to all the newbies showing up with the hashtag Bleacher Tweets. Don't be shy. Send them in, please.
That's it for today. My thanks to Hembo, to Clinton, to Taylor. Have a great day, everybody. Thanks for listening. Stay safe.
Thanks for listening to the Baseball Tonight podcast. If you're playing fantasy baseball, don't forget to listen to the Fantasy Focus podcast. Check out all podcasts at ESPN.com/podcenter. Baseball Tonight, the podcast.